Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to San Diego Pride's Devout Interfaith Coalition's first ever events that we're doing. And this event tonight, we had planned originally to schedule to be an in-person event, but with COVID-19 and all that is going on right now in our world, we wanted to still try to find some time to gather and have this important conversation. And it's allowed us to bring in some amazing folks from around North America to participate tonight. My name, again, is Reverend Brandon Robertson. I serve as the lead pastor of Mission Gathering Christian Church here in San Diego. And about a year ago, me, along with some other colleagues in the faith community here in San Diego, began working with Pride to try to find ways to bring together the affirming faith communities so that we could mobilize, not just for San Diego, but for around the country, for justice for LGBT people and to bring the faith communities in as strong allies. Tonight's event is bringing together the faith traditions of Judaism, Islam, Roman Catholicism, and Protestant Christianity to have a conversation about what it's like to reconcile our faith traditions with our queer identities. And it's our hope that these conversations spark your interest. I hope they are inspiring to you. And I want to let you know that you can follow along and send in your questions and comments. We'll be looking at those. And then towards the end of our live stream tonight, we'll be taking some of your questions. So with all of that said, I want to thank you all for being with us. And now I'd like to allow our panelists to introduce themselves. So hello, everyone. If we can just go around in the Hollywood Square style that we have here, we'll start I'll start and then we'll go across the top and down and around. If we can say our name, our faith tradition, our title and our pronouns, that would be super helpful. And again, one more time, I'm Brandon Robertson. I'm the pastor of Mission Gathering Christian Church. I identify as he, him, his, and I'm Protestant Christian.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Daniel Atwood. Thank you so much, Brandon, for inviting me to tonight's event. I'm based in New York, so it's nice to connect both across space and across regions of the country. I use he, his, him pronouns. I am Jewish, Orthodox, ordained, and I work for the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York.
Awesome.
I'm Reverend Corey Pistiniak, they, them, their pronouns. I'm the pastor of Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community here in San Diego, and I've been there for 3 years, and that's based out of the Roman Catholic tradition, and we're what's called a non-canonical Catholic church, so we're not under the jurisdiction of the Vatican because they don't recognize my ordination and all of that, so we're sort of a island of misfit toys, as it were.
And I guess that comes to me. My name is Alfaru Kaki. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, traditional territories of a variety of different nations, but most recently the Mississaugas of the Credit River. I go by he, him pronouns. I am co-founder and imam of the Unity Mosque, and which is a gender equal, queer affirming, non-denominational specific mosque space. And I identify myself as just Muslim, so non-denominational, and I am also a Sufi dervish. I don't see that as a separate category, but part and parcel of my just Muslim identity, so.
Well, it is such an honor to have all of you with us. In different ways, I've gotten the chance to follow each of your journeys from a distance, and it's been inspiring to me, and I know it's going to be inspiring to the community gathered here with us tonight. The first question that I think makes sense in this conversation is I would like to invite each of you to take 3 minutes, give or take, to answer this very complex and unfair question to ask you to answer in 3 minutes, which is a question that a lot of people in each of our traditions might ask. How can you be queer and Orthodox Jewish, Roman Catholic, Muslim? And what does that process look like for you as you've sought to reconcile that? So I'll pass it also back this way to you, Rabbi.
Thank you. So in some ways, how can I be Jewish and queer and gay? I mean, that's what I am. I was born both of those, and I don't see either of those identities as something that is changeable in my life, nor would I want to change either of those identities. And it really depends what your starting point is. So I think often in religious communities, the starting point is queer people are not, you know, welcome, are not part, are something that has to be reconciled because there are verses in the Bible and whatnot that either say or imply, depends how you interpret, negative things about queer people or queer actions. And so the assumption is that, you know, it's not, it's a negative thing, it's not welcome. And I think it's important to challenge that basic assumption, because a lot of the, you know, what is the basis for the historic exclusion of queer people from religious spaces and specifically from positions of leadership in religious spaces, from being rabbis? Queer people only started being rabbis, even in the most liberal traditions of Judaism. I don't want to say wrong. I think the 70s, but the 70s until today, openly queer, I should say. And if we look at the texts and we look at the traditions and we look at the customs, they're not only not as bad as people think, I think they can actually be quite affirming. There's a lot of, if we take that position of stepping back, not making assumptions that everything that, you know, you can't be, you obviously can't be Jewish and gay because Leviticus says that two men can't sleep with each other like he sleeps with a woman, which is a very cryptic verse. If you don't start with that assumption that that means that everything is bad, then actually there's a whole huge tradition that a very rich tradition that we have. Something that speaks to me a lot is the story of David and Jonathan from 1 Samuel. King David is sort of, you know, seen as he's the second king of Israel and sort of the leader of the Jewish kingdom and the who established the Jewish kingdom, and he had a male lover, and it's pretty explicit in 1 Samuel. Who he loved like himself. And when you take that all together and have, I'm sorry if I'm going on. And if you start with, if your starting place is not that everything is bad, but if you start from a more neutral place, you'll actually find that there are a lot of really, really good things. And you can and will lead a really rich life as a queer Jewish person.
I love that. I think that's such a good explanation. And I love that that thought that our traditions, which are so often thought to be non-affirming, actually within themselves a lot of the time have these queer threads that run through them, and discovering those can be so helpful. So thank you. Reverend Corey?
Thanks. I think part of my answer to that would stem a bit with and resonate with what Rabbi Daniel said of, you know, God created me this way, and that's just how it is. So to say that you can't be Christian or Catholic and queer and trans, to me is like, well, then do I not exist? Because I exist, and all these things are part of me. And so there's definitely been an aspect in my life of less reconciling like faith in a broad sense and more trying to find my place in a church or a faith community, because the personal faith level has always been strong. And for me, that kind of boils down to the belief that God is love. And therefore, if I believe that I am created and that all of us are created in the image of God, whether we're cisgender or transgender, or whether we're queer or straight or whatever we are, that each of us reflects God's image and the diversity and the beauty of God, then I can't see anything wrong in that. And I think that's for me where the baseline is. And from there, it just sort of evolves. Like, so how do we make our communities of faith as affirming as I believe God is? And so, you know, I think for me, it becomes that I think God's plan for each of us is human flourishing. And, you know, if we look at the numbers of trans and queer youth who are at higher risks for depression and suicide, especially in communities where they're not affirmed, then I think it's up to communities of faith to be that affirming voice, to be that support for them so that they don't feel that there's no place for them in a house of worship or in a community that's built on spirituality and love, as I'm pretty sure all of our communities are.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And Imam Al-Farouk?
Yeah, I don't know whether the best part or the worst part is to go last after the folks who certainly have very similar sort of concepts about self. I have been asked this question many times. How can you be queer and be Muslim? Ironically, often by people who are queer from non-Muslim faith traditions. excuse me. Sometimes even by queer Muslims themselves who are struggling with sort of reconciling. pardon me. I am who I am. I am Muslim and I am queer. And I, like you said, Corey, this is how I am made in God's image. To ask me this question would suppose that there is a contradiction, that there is something wrong in God's plan. This is just who I am. My journey has been, how do I understand these two things as being intrinsic and innately part of myself and how they work together? I think that, in fact, I can say this now, sitting at this end of or at this place in my journey through life and through Islam, is that my queerness has been a gift, because it has allowed me a perspective and has pushed me to challenge my tradition and to re-examine my tradition with an open vision and an open heart, that I'm not sure if I had not been queer, I would have had access to or even been compelled to explore. So my gender activism, my liberational theology, if you will, that is focused around issues of otherness and gender and so on, actually come from this place of otherness and finding voice within a tradition which is not monolithic, which is actually quite complex, but where narratives have been erased or misinterpreted because they challenge notions around gender and patriarchy and so on. So my journey has been one also of embracing gender diversity and gender inclusion as a necessary part of being queer, because I'm not just queer because I am gay, but I'm also queer because of my politic, which is about centralizing the other. So it's been not an easy journey, but I think a very valuable journey for me. And I would say it's really easy, but it hasn't always been easy, but I can say that now, so.
Totally. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Obviously, none of us in our traditions are the first or the new reformers or anything like that, because there has been these queer voices in all of our traditions throughout the ages, really. And one of the questions that I think a lot of people have for us, and we've touched on it a little bit, each of us, is most of our problems with affirmation of our identity come because of verses in our sacred texts, be it the Bible, be it the Quran, be it the Catechism of the Catholic Church, these documents that are held as a standard of what truth is supposed to be. And in many traditions, that truth is seen as final and for all time. So I just want to raise the question, and this one we don't have to go in any certain order. If you feel compelled to speak to it, I welcome you to. How do you deal with the texts and the people who look to these texts as kind of the final standard on faith, because so many of them do seem to have a pretty explicitly non-affirming perspective.
Sorry again. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, sure. There's there's the text, and there are definitely difficult texts. And I think one advantage queer people have is that we're able to see those texts in ways that I think that people who don't have that direct experience are able to understand it. These texts, a lot of them are cryptic. It's important to understand the context. When I think of some of the verses in my tradition in the Torah from Leviticus that are not affirming, it's important to remember this is a pre-patriarchal context, and the way marriage and love and relationships work today is completely different than the way it worked in earlier times. And I would say it's less about what's there and more about what's not there that hurts people. Because these texts, it's like a line here, a line there. And it's not, I don't think these are the things keeping people up at night. It's the lack of recognition, and it's the texts that talk about marriage between a man and a woman as being, this sort of sacred thing, and there's no other way to do it. Texts that talk about men and women, not just as two genders, but as having different roles in society. And what's not there is a spirit of egalitarianism and affirmation all the time. I mean, sometimes there is. And I think that's our role as queer leaders, as a queer rabbi. I definitely see that as my role, to look at these texts in new ways. But it's what's not there. That I think hurts a lot of people. And it's a very exciting opportunity that I have to interpret and teach about these texts in new ways.
Yeah.
And I would add to that one of the things that I've been really grateful for is the work of queer scholarship on this topic. So, there are some amazing folks doing work on queer biblical scholarship, both in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, and just seeing them wrestle with the original languages at a level that I cannot approach and I don't try to, has been really helpful. And then sharing that with the community, because often the people who are wielding these sacred texts as weapons against LGBTQ folks haven't actually done the work. So they're usually just getting like the, Leviticus something or other, a man shall not lie with a man as with his wife or some, and they'll just pull it that way without any idea of the context in which Leviticus was written, what it was meant to do, what, like, all these possible interpretations. But they're like, and then maybe some pastor, some priest told me that this is why, gay people are going to hell, and they haven't done the work. And like Daniel said, is that when those verses affect you personally, I think you feel compelled to do the work, especially if you feel called to some sort of religious vocation or service, that it's your life that's being talked about and discussed, and your identity and your very soul. And so it hits you in a different way. And often when I do sort of trans 101 things in churches, I'll toss out the quote that's, the Bible contains 6 admonishments for homosexuals and 362 admonishments for heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that God doesn't love heterosexuals. It's just that they need more supervision. Right. And,
brilliant.
And someone did this. I learned this in my undergraduate intro to Bible course, and it got written down as a young undergrad, and I keep pointing it out, and people say, wait, but that can't possibly be right. I was like, well, I'm not going to go through all of scripture and count it, but if you want to, be my guest. But I think, there's some of that of, you can't, there's contradictions in sacred texts almost always. And so it's not so about picking and choosing, but for me, it's a theology that errs on the side of love, right? So how am I going to interpret these sacred texts in a way that is affirming and loving and in the image of a God who is love. And I think the stumbling block more in my life has been with the catechism. And there's a line of, you know, the homosexual orientations being intrinsically morally disordered. And that just, that took a long time to wrestle with. And then there's this other line in the catechism of how every Catholic is told to follow their own conscience, that their conscience is where the buck stops, basically. And I was like, oh, so if I'm okay being queer and trans, then I guess God's okay with it too. And I don't know where I fit in the church yet, but that part at least was helpful. And just that notion that a lot of the interpretation of these texts has been done in systems that were built on homophobic structures or on the exclusion of people from the full life in faith communities. And so realizing that there's that error in them or room for new interpretations, right? And I think that's where I see life of having people and friends like say, well, what if we interpret this book this way or something like that, or this passage in a new light?
Totally. Thank you for that.
From the Muslim perspective, this is not an easy answer. In the contemporary Muslim tradition, there seems to be a widespread notion that the sacred texts condemn homosexuality and homosexual behavior. The primary reference is made to the story of the people of Lot. So Sodom and Gomorrah are not named, but these are called the cities of the plains. And we're told that these refer to homosexual behavior. So a lot of Muslim work around this also relies heavily on Jewish and Christian contemporary work around these passages. But it's not just contemporary, like some of the earlier discourses and the tafsirs, the exegesis and the commentary on text didn't understand the crimes of the people of Lot to be necessarily homosexual behavior. The Quran says they cut off the ways, they cut off the roads. So this is about travelers' hospitality. It is about violence and abusing travelers, when in fact the cultural code of the region is quite the opposite. You were supposed to offer hospitality and sanctuary, as opposed to, then there's also the whole tradition in that region at that time of temple prostitution and so on and so forth, and how it affected the people from Lot's community that were located in these cities. But the whole context of it is erased. And in the early Muslim context, it's also important to note that the Prophet Muhammad often directed people to the rabbis in Medina, because it was sort of understood that you couldn't understand Islam without understanding Judaism and Christianity. But there weren't any Christians, there weren't very many Christians in the Hijaz at that time, but there were certainly well-established Jewish communities in the central part. The Christian communities were in the south, in the Yemen and so on. But so the Prophet would say, go ask the rabbis, because, you know, they had that background. And he didn't come from a Jewish background. He came from an Arab background. There was a notion of monotheists in the Arab communities called Hanifs, who were connected to Abraham and the teachings of Abraham, right? But were not Jewish or Christian identified. So how do I reconcile? You know, in Islam, we don't have any imagery of the divine, but we know God, or we approach God through the 99 most beautiful attributes, or the 99 most beautiful names. Of the 114 chapters of the Quran, 113 begin with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the tenderly compassionate, the infinitely loving, or some variation thereof in terms of interpretation. And I think that provides us the lens. God is telling us, when you read what I am saying to you, read it knowing that I am the tenderly compassionate, the infinitely merciful, the giver of mercy, the whose mercy is the word. The words Rahman and Rahim both come from the same Arabic root word for womb. So many feminist and contemporary progressive interpreters understand that we're being told that God's love and compassion is akin to the womb of a parent as they are growing a child, and so on. So if that is the image of the Creator that we have, then anything that we read in terms of the Creator's communication with us has to be filtered through that lens. And surely no God creates people a particular way to then just punish them. I think the problem with some of the stories, so with the story of the people of Lot, you know, it's very similar, I guess, to the biblical narrative. These pretty boy angels show up at Lot's door and ask for protection. By nightfall, there's a horde of men who want him to hand them over to her, to them. There's no question of consent. The Quran talks about you approach these men with lust, or that's how it's interpreted, but it's actually with bad habits or with whatever. But there's no question here of consent. And so, you know, I guess straight cisgendered folks, I don't know, have a hard time with, you know, sexual violence is violence and issues around consent. I mean, certainly this is certainly a gendered issue, but it then comes into the understanding of where the violence is in this verse. But the key to all of this is the lens with which you come, the open heart or the closed heart, that you come to the text. So all of our texts and all of our traditions can be the source of love and can be the source of violence, and the source of othering. So that's how I deal with my sacred texts. And sometimes within the Muslim context, because Muslims do believe that the Quran is the revealed word of God, what doesn't make sense may be our limitation or our lack of understanding rather than a fault of the divine plan. And so the revelation is also constantly revealing itself to us. There are two revelations. One is nature and the other are the books that have been sent. So
I love all of that. And it reminds me that in each of our traditions, there is this call to, in some senses, see our text as living documents. The way I talk about it to my community is Jesus had this great line that said, I'm leaving the earth, but when I go, I'm going to send you the Spirit whose job is to continue to lead you into truth. This idea that truth will be ongoingly revealed throughout time, and what was true at one time for a certain context may not be the truth in another context. And in some sense, I hear a little bit of that in all of our responses and how we're engaging with the texts. So thank you for that. And we also, each of us represent what a lot of people would say are anomalies in our religious traditions, right? To be occupying the space as queer faith leaders causes some people to raise their eyebrows and say, how is this possible? I didn't even know this world existed. But we actually do, as I mentioned earlier, come from a long line of reform within each of our faith traditions. And I wonder if you could give some insight about past traditions that have been, or past movements of reform in your own tradition, or current movements that are happening that people might not know about that are calling for a more inclusive version of each one of our faiths.
Yes, I mean, Judaism has a long, long history of sectarianism and of different groups going way, way back. But even more in modern history, a lot of the more inclusive stances towards queer people started with Reform Judaism, Reconstructionist Judaism, which are more socially liberal of traditions of Judaism. And it took a really long time, and is still happening, for more conservative traditions of Judaism to come on board. So conservative, with a big C, conservative Judaism, only started accepting homosexuality a little over 10 years ago. And Orthodox Judaism as a movement still has not come around to accept homosexuality or gay marriage or trans people. There's a lot of movement on the grassroots level, and I think that's what keeps me going and really inspires me, is seeing a lot of people who go to synagogues, go to temples, are part of institutions that are not so queer affirming, and maybe they never really thought about it because they just didn't think about it until they had a gay son, until they had a trans child. And then they were like, wait, why does my synagogue not accept queer people? I think that's the story of my family very much. I grew up in an Orthodox, very traditional community, which did not have any openly LGBT people. And then people came out, and I when I got married last year to my husband, so many of my friends and my parents' friends who have been attending that synagogue for decades wished me congratulations, came to the wedding, were happy for us, even though the rabbi of the synagogue I grew up in would never have thought of coming to our wedding. So there's that grassroots level is really where there's a big disconnect in the places where it's not happening between people on the ground and a lot of the rabbis and institutions, which have politics and move slow and this and that. But the people throughout history, queer history until today, who have fought and continue to fight for their place, that's where I really see the change happening.
Thank you.
I often like to remind folks that there's not one monolithic Catholicism. And I think this is true probably for Christianity more broadly, for Islam, for Judaism, for all of us. You can't just say, oh, well, Catholicism believes this, or Judaism believes that, or Islam says this, you know? And so when I teach, I talk about how there's multiple Catholicisms. And we're talking about probably something like 6 million Catholics, more or less, in the world. And trying to find one thing that everyone believes, you know, they're not going to be in the same place. And a lot of what I think you're seeing now in the Catholic Church is a difference between pastoral approaches and sort of the doctrine of the church failing to catch up. And so, you know, there's a lot of great folks who have done work. So, I mean, in terms of organizations, Dignity, Call to Action, you know, several groups like that that have been around since before Vatican II in the 60s and 70s, have done some amazing work to try and make spaces for LGBTQ Catholics. And then nowadays, you know, you've got nuns and priests and lay people doing all sorts of work of ministering to queer folks and just reminding people that they're as much God's beloved children as any of us. And, you know, Pope Francis sending out mixed messages. On one hand, he's like, who am I to judge? On the other hand, it's like, oh, gender ideology is, you know, the work of the devil, kind of, or is akin to child abuse. And it's, and those are hard things. People think, oh, Pope Francis is great. And I'm just like, he's done a lot of really great things. And there are a couple of his statements that I think certainly rub me the wrong way, right? And I'm sure some other folks too. And I think, like Daniel, a lot is the grassroots. And so, you know, seeing the transformation in my own friends and family of folks who started out being very, well, what the Catholic Church says is what I believe. And I was like, but is it really? Because you're perfectly fine with a divorced person in your church. even though that's not allowed. And you're perfectly fine with a person who had that child out of wedlock, and that's not an issue. But yet, the second you have an out gay teacher at a Catholic school, we have to fire them, right? And so it's this, there's a lot of inconsistency in how certain moral codes are imposed. But then those same people will be like, oh, well, my grandchild came out to me as trans. Can you help me? Or the, well, I stopped going to church because, you know, my child or my friend had a, you know, a gay wedding. And so now what do I do? And I'm just like, well, you know, if the church isn't going to, says you can't be there, then the church is wrong. And there are places that you can be. And I think it's very hard for people for whom religion is as much a cultural identity as just what they believe to find, to reconcile that aspect of what I was taught is not the only way that that religion can be, right? Because it's very, we want to sometimes cling to tradition, cling to our cultural identity that we share with our family. And when your existence or some of your beliefs come into conflict with that, then you have to create something new or go outside the boundaries or outside the margins of the church. Yeah, you know, it can be incredibly scary. So I think, you know, that's why a lot of, I think my work is often just letting people know that communities like mine exist, right? Yeah. That there are groups at canonical churches, at non-canonical churches, that are fully open and affirming and will take you as you are, will celebrate, and not just despite your queerness, right? Because I think that's a lot of what we see from mainstream groups is like the, oh, you are gay, we still love you. And sure, your husband can come, Daniel, he can come with you. Oh, but you want to celebrate your anniversary here. Oh, well, can you not talk about him when you're, you know, that sort of in between hedging of things is what we see. Whereas I'm like, but it's not that we love you despite your queerness. We love you because of your queerness. We love every aspect of your gender, of your sexuality, that all make up you. And I think that's the message that, you know, I really want to spread to people of as you are, all of you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Me. You know, I premise our services by saying that Islam is not a monolith and it never has been. And so even interpretive choices begin very early on to manifest. Diversity manifests very early in Muslim tradition, and certainly with the after the death of the Prophet, where the leadership went and the formation of Shia and, sorry, I my computer screen went black, of Shia and Sunni communities. And just as Muslim theology is not monolithic, Islam is historically been practiced in a very large geographical span. And so there have always been form and reform and deform movements in different parts of the world, responding to the social, cultural, and political necessities in that area and in those communities. So whether that's in the form of Sufi sheikhs or like the Mahdis of Sudan, or reformers that came up in different parts of the world, and so on and so forth. That has always been, but what is it that they've been advocating? What is it that they've been reforming and so on? And that has always been a question of response. And, you know, my Sufi teacher was talking the other day, quite interestingly, just very recently, that maybe that as a Sufi teacher, what he has to do in his community is learn about gender and so on and so forth. As a straight man, this is what he has to learn and understand. But maybe if he had been born, if he was teaching 200 years ago or 500 years ago, there would have been a different need and a different necessity that he had had to address as a teacher and the leader of a community. And so again, stuff that the folks who come and they do a little bit of change and they shift things and they open up or they contract spaces and theologies, it's hard to enumerate, and we will only get some but not others. There's also a conflab in the Muslim, when understanding Muslims, that, you know, everybody's either Arab or Middle Eastern or South Asian, whereas, you know, we have an incredible racial diversity within the Islamic tradition, Black, East Asian, Asian, European. In contemporary times, I think it's also important to understand that large swaths of the contemporary Muslim world were colonized by European, i.e. Christian powers, and that we were left with despotic tyrants and leaders, and non-democratic or only pseudo-democratic institutions when the Europeans left. And that the majority of our, or large portions of our populations, live with poverties and disadvantages that don't exist in the Western, predominantly Christian, predominantly white parts of this planet. And so it's really important to understand that as a larger context in terms of even the issues that, that our reform movements have dealt with or that have been the focus. Now, in the last, I would say, number of years, there has been gender issues have always been, and there's a wide historical narrative around exploration of gender and all of these sorts of issues. But I think in the contemporary world, I think it's, you know, important to understand Islam and what happens in the Muslim world in this context, but also the impact of oil. And so I often talk about how oil contaminates not just our environment, but how it is contaminated our religion and our spirituality. I would say in the last 20, 30 years, you know, as conversations around gender and sexuality in the West are being centralized and opening up spaces, even in religious spaces and so on and so forth, for Muslim populations living in as minorities in some of these societies, these have also become issues. Now, we had the whole, the whole 9/11. And one of the things that happened around technology and 9/11 is that before 9/11, there were already conversations that were taking place online. There were already groups that were forming, that were connecting Muslims in diverse places who were like, I don't really fit into my mosque. I don't get why this is happening. I don't get why women can't do this. I don't understand this issue or that issue, particularly around gender. And then from the gender, it started to open up into sexual orientation. And it's really important to, you know, that in the contemporary sort of, I don't like using the word reform, because it then might suggest other issues and other religious traditions and their history and so on and so forth. I like to talk about creating inclusive spaces, because there the proof is in the pudding. It's not in what you say you believe. It's actually what you do. And so creating an inclusive space that welcomes all kinds of diversities is that manifestation of whatever you claim your theology or your inclusion is about. So if you are, I'll give you an example. We had one Friday prayer where a woman joined, and, you know, I had met her at a couple of other events, and we don't gender our space. So people are free to pray like in Mecca next to anyone that they are comfortable, whatever their gender might be or gender identity might be. We also don't impose a dress code. So you've got people who are dressed traditionally and people who are dressed non-traditionally. And she was fine with all of that. She's standing next to me. She's wearing a hijab. She's dressed sort of in a more traditional than most of the female identified folks in that room. There was maybe about 30 people. But because we're also a diverse community in that we have people from all of the different Muslim traditions and non-Muslim traditions as well. The person who was leading the prayer was female identified and Shia. And as soon as I said, because the majority of the folks come from Sunni backgrounds, there are slight variations in the prayer. So I say, and, you know, blah, 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 in the second rakat, there's going to be a kanut. And so don't worry, this is part of the Shia. Well, the Shia thing just turn this person off. She grabbed her purse and she, in the from the prayer line, we were lined up for prayer. We were about to start, like literally seconds. She went, Shia, shook her head and walked away. She was fine with the queer. She was fine with the woman leading. She was fine with a woman who was not wearing a headscarf leading. She was fine praying next to a gay man. She was not fine praying behind, right? So how do we even construct a progressive space? So I talk about creating inclusive spaces. And certainly the Unity Mosque is part of a larger and a growing movement of people who some identify as being progressive. I don't, like I said, I find that word a little bit problematic because it's easy to pat yourself on the back. But what the proof is what you do and the kind of spaces that you create. But certainly the Unity Mosque is part of the Alliance of Inclusive Muslims. There are growing groups and organizations. And there's a growing awareness, again, that there are many different ways of being Muslim. One of the challenges, just as I can throw that in, you know, I was talking to an acquaintance of mine some years ago, I was introduced by a mutual friend, and he said, you know, I love your Islam, he says. And this guy was from Iran and from a Muslim background, didn't identify as Muslim. He goes, you know, you and Scott, you talk to me about Islam, I love your Islam, but it's not Islam. right. So we, you know, we face this challenge from the outside, and we also face this challenge on the inside. And one of the other challenges, in all honesty, you know, before the rise of Trumpism and white nationalism in recent years, when queer Muslims did anything that was out in the media, we would have homophobic Muslims reply and make nasty comments. Now we also have like non-Muslims, nasty non-Muslims making comments against us. So it's sometimes an uncomfortable place to be sandwiched. I just want to point out that female-led imams in contemporary times has actually been spearheaded by queer communities, and that's something that's now going on in non-queer spaces. And sometimes, again, our contribution is sort of erased or put aside because you don't want to taint your what you're doing with what those folks have done. But things are changing. I think that one of the greater challenges is dealing with closeted allies who in private will tell you that they're with you, but for whatever reason, and I understand safety and security and all and communal pressure and so on and so forth. So this is what both Corey and Daniel spoke to, which is, you know, people in congregations being sometimes more forthcoming than the leadership in a particular community or so on and so forth. And I think you're certainly starting to see, we're seeing that particularly for folks who are living in more secular and diverse spaces and places.
Totally. And I'm glad you went there, because that is the next question I want to ask, is kind of on behalf of the allies and all of our traditions and all of our communities, just a little of my experience with this. For years, I've been working with evangelical communities across the country that have pastors and leaders who actually want to stand up and say our church is LGBT inclusive, but know that when they do, even if they feel it's the right thing, that people and money and privilege and influence goes out the door. Now, on one hand, if we're talking about faith communities, I think all of our traditions call people to put the moral and ethical above their own personal power and privilege and money. And yet, what would we say to those people in our traditions? How can we encourage them or assist them, those faith leaders, or people in various kinds of faith communities that want to help move inclusion forward, but are afraid of that social pressure, are afraid of losing potentially the faith community itself because of taking a stand for queer inclusion? I wonder if we have any insight or wisdom to offer there.
Yeah, it's a problem I have encountered so many times. The people who want to be more inclusive but can't because of political or financial concerns, you know, our donors, our board, our institution, the rabbinical association, whatever, is not going to approve of this. So, I mean, oftentimes I think it's important to interrogate, you know, how, like, oh, I really, really want to, but I can't, like, maybe there's some work to be done there and how much you really want to. But, okay, like, even assuming, let's say that is the case, when someone is ordained as a rabbi, they receive, it's like a certificate, it's called a klaf, and it says, yore, yore, this person shall teach, they shall teach. And being a rabbi means you have the ability to teach and to make decisions on matters of Jewish law, and you should be a leader in the community. Actually, the primary subject matter studied to become a rabbi is Jewish law. A lot of it is very obscure, very technical, and a way, you know, there's a lot of communal things and interesting things and history and philosophy that one studies as well. But law is really the backbone of being a rabbi and of the Jewish text. And this is what your title is. This is what you were, like, this is what your job is. And, you know, if you want, like, in some ways, I hate to judge people, but, you know, if you're not gonna do what you were trained to do, then don't do it. Because this is, you know, this is your life. This is your opportunity. This is what I really feel a very deep responsibility of. You know, when I became a rabbi, it's a responsibility of the community. It's a responsibility from God, that God is in the decisions I make don't just reflect me. They are now reflective of the Torah and of God. So, you know, there are always concerns, but you need to really be thinking about, are the decisions you're making reflective of the Torah and of God? Because that's what you need to be doing.
Yeah. I love that.
I think I remember the first time I got told that. It was as an undergraduate, and I was told that, you know, oh, well, someone really supported my call to ordination, but they could never say so publicly, because they would probably lose their status as a priest and their job as a professor and everything. Like, but I'm with you. And I was like, but are you? And, you know, as someone who has at times struggled with depression, and, you know, what I try to do is I remind people that it can be a matter of life and death, right? That you're sitting here talking about financial security and endowments and respectability, and I'm sitting here, you know, with Layla Alcorn's, you know, suicide note running through my head, right? You know, that of folks who have taken their own lives because they did not think they would be accepted at home because of their parents' religious beliefs. Like, that is what weighs on my heart. And so I really wrestle with what to tell folks who say, oh, well, I want to support you, or I do support you, but I'm just not sure. And, you know, we were having a conversation in my community about pronouns and just normalizing the use of pronouns. And people are like, well, I can't really, I don't understand they, them as a pronoun. That's weird. It's not grammatically correct. And I mean, I'm sure most of us have heard that spiel. And then someone goes, well, how can I help? And I said, I want you to have that conversation with other people, right? That it shouldn't always be my job to have the conversation about pronouns. That if you want to be a good ally, then have those conversations about pronouns. Have conversations with your kids. Don't make this into, like, don't perpetuate the heteronormative narrative that, oh, little Susie is going to grow up to marry a nice boy at some point. You know, maybe Susie will marry a nice boy. Maybe Susie will marry a nice girl. Maybe Susie won't get married at all. Maybe Susie will tell us that Susie is really Michael. I mean, we don't know, but trying to make the most, you know, goes back to what Al-Farouk said of trying to make the most inclusive environment we can, right? And so, and I tell people, and I think a lot of it is also, how do we do that? And sometimes we have to take risks, right? I mean, in a Catholic tradition, I mean, we've got a long tradition of folks who risk everything for their faith and for the love of God. And if we are sitting here and our board members or our donors or our religious leaders are sitting here and they would rather sit in their fancy houses of worship with their, you know, wealthy housing allowance and everything, and are not willing to do the grassroots work and are not willing to throw the doors of the church or the mosque or the temple wide open to everyone, then I don't know. I don't know how they reconcile that with their God, because I don't think I could. And so I think it's, I mean, maybe that's calling some folks out a little too much, but I think, you know, you have to, our faith, we don't believe because it's easy. We believe because God calls us to something more. And sometimes that involves taking risks, and sometimes that involves losing money. And I mean, most clergy will tell you, you don't become clergy or a religious leader to get rich. Like, this is not, you know, we're not going to get those $1 million book deals and endorsements from Nike and everything. I mean, it'd be really nice, but I've got student loan debt. You know, it's going to be with me for a while. So I think you just have to at some point say, this is where God is leading me, and I invite you to walk beside me and join me on this journey into the wilderness. And if you're not ready now, I hope you will be in the future, right? And little by little, sometimes I think you can wear those people down through personal stories and helping them to understand how much is at stake for queer and trans folks. But I think it's a lot of conversation and a lot of relationship building so that they can see what the stakes are.
That was incredible. Thank you.
Mm. I'm tired. I'm tired. I don't want to have to be explaining racism to folks who don't understand racism. I don't want to be explaining homophobia or misogyny or transphobia to folks who don't get it. For me, a religious path, for those of us who've chosen not just to practice a faith, but to be leaders within our traditions in some capacity or another. We are called to authenticity. And yet we also know from all of our traditions how authority can be used to perpetuate abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and certainly against queers and trans folk, spiritual violence, right? I think this whole, what I was talking about earlier, the dichotomy between North and South populations, the historical context of those populations, and also the role of industrialization in the separation of church or religion and state, something that has not been allowed to happen and develop naturally in non-Western parts of the world. Like the Industrial Revolution, the Black Plague, and other things actually did result in at least some form of separation of church and state. That's not happened in a lot of Muslim spaces. We also don't have the formalized structure that, for example, while we do have a Shia-Sunni dichotomy and some of the Shia, smaller Shia communities are centralized, we don't have a form of centralized organization. For example, Daniel, when you talked about reform and Reconstructionist and Orthodox and conservative movements, we don't have, you know, councils of conservative imams a coalition of reform mosques. We don't have that because that's not how historically. So this then affects how we are accountable to our communities, how we are funded, and also how we sort of approach. So coming back to I am tired, I shouldn't have to explain authenticity and what we are being called to do, which is to serve. One of my friends at a conference I was at 4 years ago, we have this concept in Islam around shura and the issuance of fatwa. A fatwa is just a legal opinion. But, and shura means consultation. But you cannot have a legal opinion without actually consulting the party or the parties that are affected by your proclamation. So you can't make statements about queer people and about same-sex marriage or about this or about that without actually consulting and the realities and the opinions of the folks that you are issuing this opinion, that are going to be affected by this opinion that you issue. That's not happening. That's not happening, not just with queers, but with everybody else, right? So our, even the historical checks and balances that are in many of our traditions have been eroded because they're not convenient sometimes. I just don't feel that I need to be convincing people that they need to do the right thing. Honestly, I'm really tired and I don't actually engage that conversation. To be honest with you, one of the strategies that I've been employing, and I think some of my peers who are doing similar kinds of work are doing, is building our own foundation, our own networks, and our own visibility, and so that we actually become something to be reckoned with. And when we have that, then they will come to us. I just don't think that I need to be hand-holding, and I'm not going to do that. But I do hope that these folks at some point are moved by their conscience, by the spirit, by their faith, by their convictions for justice. Muslims talk a lot about justice, that this will eventually compel more and more people to take certain positions. I want to throw out that one of the interesting things, like, you know, in Canada, that we sort of see is a lot of Muslim spaces are accepting of non-Muslim queers, but not of Muslim queers. So when I was running in 2009, I ran for federal parliament. I live in an area which has the neighborhood, but also very large immigrant Muslim populations. And I spoke to somebody about trying to help me get access to one of the Muslim communities. And he said, "Oh, I've already tried, but they just can't get over with the fact that you are gay and Muslim. But they're voting for and sitting on election teams for queers who are not Muslim, but they won't even cast a vote for me," right? So this has also been part of this, which I don't know whether other faith traditions are encountering that, or queers from other faith traditions, but certainly one of the things that I have been seeing is, so, you know, National Muslim Organization has an anti-bullying sort of thing. They call in EGAL, which is our national queer organization, but they won't call in the queer Muslim organization to be there. Right, because then they don't want to be seen in certain sections of the Muslim community as supporting these folks. But then they can support those queers because it's not a theological issue; it's a civil issue. So, I'm tired. I don't want to deal with it. That's their problem, not mine. So, short answer.
I love that. I think in my own world, we often use this phrase among LGBT Christians. Say that we don't need to wait to be a part of the church, we already are the church. Yeah. And it kind of sounds like that's what we're all saying is, I love the idea of not having to wait around for a mosque to become inclusive or a synagogue to become inclusive, but let's just do our own thing, be who we are, and allow them to come to us. I think there's real power in that. So we talked a little bit in this past question about what it's like for perhaps young people in our traditions. What is it like? How would you speak to a young person in one of your faith communities that you know is surrounded by kind of non-affirming messages? And we know psychologically now there's been plenty of studies that show growing up in non-affirming religious communities causes significant psychological harm. What would you say, what advice would you give as a faith leader to someone, a youth that might be in your tradition that's trying to reconcile their faith and sexuality and trying to figure out how to do this, come out with their families and their community and all of that on the line?
Maybe I'll go first on this one. I often ask people why do they need to come out and why do they need to come out now? Because not everybody is in a safe place. But I get people from all over the world. So it's not, sometimes it's not a question of your faith community, it's the whole society. When somebody's contacting me from somewhere in the Middle East or in Asia or in Africa and so on and so forth. And my day job is as a lawyer, and I do refugee asylum work where the majority of my clients are seeking protection because of their sexual orientation or their gender identity or their gender expression or their gender. And often about 15 to 20% of my clients are HIV positive. About 60% of my clients are female identified. So the advice I give is very much based on where the person is. If they're in a place like Toronto or somewhere in Canada or North America, maybe they have more options. And often the option is that as soon as they're of age, they run and they don't look back. Which is, and a lot of folks that I end up talking to is like, you know, I stopped being Muslim, I gave up, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm not interested anymore. Maybe if I'd met you 10 years ago or 20 years ago, depending on the age. One of the things that I do try to do is to instill this notion that Islam is not a monolith. There is not just one way of looking at our traditions or in understanding them. And the other thing that I try to do is I try to link folks up, even if it is only online, because the creation of online communities has been very central in the progressive or inclusive Muslim movement. And a lot of times people think that they're alone, not just because they are gay and Muslim, but just because they're the only ones that they know in the mosque and so on and so forth. So we've had to reimagine our sense of community. So, I mean, this is a prime example. So since we started the Unity Mosque in 2009, and shortly after we started putting our service, our Friday service, out on Skype. And so we started getting folks from not only around Toronto, but around Canada through the United States. Then we started getting international folks. We then moved on to Facebook Live, and that so that we also had a recording, which then people were able to access, and so on and so forth. Now, since the beginning of COVID, we've moved on to one of these meeting platforms, and we had over 100 people last Friday, and coming in from across North America, but also folks coming in from South Africa, from Europe, from East Africa, from the Middle East, and so on and so forth. And then this notion of I'm not the only one in my community, and in fact, our affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin started because there were two people on our Facebook Live broadcast on a Friday. And at the end, when people are introducing themselves, it was like, oh, well, what part of the city do you live in? And now they have a Unity Mosque community starting in Madison, Wisconsin. So this is what we are trying to do. And this is what we're trying to sort of, so that people know that they're not the only ones, right? Because instilled in people is, I like your Islam, but it's not Islam. And so finding that space of authenticity and manifestation, so it's not just in theory, but there's actually a space and a connection, and you're not the only one who thinks this way, or you're not the only one with this need. There's actually, and it might not be the person sitting next to you, it might be a person 5,000 miles away, but that's okay. So,
thank you.
It's hard to go after that. I think, you know, much of what El Farouk said resonates with me, and you know, it'd be similar things to employ, because I think none of our faith traditions are monoliths, right? And I think the moment when each of us found out that we weren't the only one was definitely a moment of affirmation. And I think one of the things that I've done in sort of ministerial context is offer to sit with those people, whether it's in person or online, and then also offer to have conversations with people's families, because sometimes they just need someone with religious authority, not even to say anything, but just to be there for that conversation. So, you know, if you've got a kid kind of trying to have that awkward thing with their parents, and you know that their parents might be threatening conversion therapy for them, you know, to have a clergy person there on their side can be the difference sometimes of just evening the playing field or something like that. But I think really just listening and hearing people's stories and letting them know that God loves them. I mean, it can be a bit cheesy, but it boils down to the fact that, you know, that there are affirming faith communities, and that, you know, I believe in an affirming God. And so I will not repeat those messages that that non-affirming faith tradition said to you, because that goes against everything I believe in and everything that I am. And, you know, I told people, I was like, look, I will meet with you, I will talk with you, and my church might not be the place for you. And that's fine, because there are, you know, we have different styles of worship, etc. You know, maybe you're not even Christian, but I will try to help you find a place where your needs can get met, you know, and to reach out and to make those connections, and so that people have a support network that is affirming, right? And if it means getting them out of a house or a home or a living situation that's dangerous, you know, and that's one of those things that we'll definitely work towards doing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great wisdom offered by my two colleagues here. So, you know, I'll just add, in the community that I was raised in the Orthodox Jewish community, and similar to Farouk, I sort of come from an Orthodox tradition, but now identify more broadly identify with such a particular denominational label, and have moved into a different space in my life. But more right-wing communities, what they tried to really do is send this message, sometimes explicitly, but really implicitly, that it's either you're all in or you're all out. And if you want to be gay and whatever, like, that's fine. But, you know, you have to just leave the community. Don't pretend to be Jewish. And I think that messaging is really internalized in a lot of young people, because I've spoken to so many people and they say, I can't leave my community. I can't, if I go to this synagogue, they're not Jewish because they're more liberal, and they're more accepting. And, you know, one of the great epiphanies I had in my life, and I would tell someone, is you don't have to be the exact way you were raised. And it sounds obvious to all of us that our traditions are not monoliths. But to a young person coming from a certain community, especially a more conservative community, it really feels that way. Like, if I'm not part of this community, then I'm out of the religion. And it's really exposing people to, obviously, taking into account their safety and where they're at and all those different factors. But people understanding, hey, like, there are spaces. You just need to sort of come around to yourself to realize and accept those spaces as well.
Totally. Thank you all for sharing that wisdom. And it is really, I am so grateful for the witness of colleagues like you all. And I'm so grateful seeing even here in the comments that just being out, being visible, is a sign of hope for so many young people and so many people in our faith communities. For our last 15 minutes together, I've kind of been compiling some questions that have been coming in from the people that have been watching. But the first one is a question that someone sent me on a private message, and I think it's actually a really important question, and it's one we've been wrestling with in my own church as as we've sought to be more inclusive. And that is, as we're building these inclusive faith communities in our various traditions, and we're calling for this radical, this intersectional inclusion, how do we deal with the exclusive seeking to become a part of our community? Can your inclusive community include those who have exclusive theologies, if that makes sense?
Let me answer that. When we gather, and I've had to adapt this etiquette for the online, sort of the fact that we don't have a physical space right now, is defining the fact that it is gender equal, that it is queer and trans affirming, the fact that we impose no dress code and people are free to express modesty as they understand it, the fact that we don't gender segregate. It has to be, it's put right out there. If you can't abide by that, then, and I'm not trying to poach anybody from anywhere else. If you're happy in your mosque, whatever that's like, then, you know, hallelujah, go for it. If you're coming into my space, because if I go into those spaces, and in all honesty, I very rarely go into those kinds of spaces anymore, because I go into places of worship for peace. And if I'm going to get triggered and angry and upset at what I see, which I often do, I just don't go. So if you're going to come into my space, then these are the parameters. And as long as you are here, then that's fine. Know your place in the sense that this is the place that you have chosen to come into. So then abide by that. If you don't like it, don't come here. So inclusive, it only goes so far, in the sense that you have to be able to open your heart to this particular framework. And if you can't, you're not going to feel comfortable. You're not going to feel comfortable praying behind a woman leading prayer who may or may not be wearing a headscarf, standing next to, you know, two guys who are married, or a trans person, or whatever. So they wouldn't even come. And if they came, they would leave very quickly. One of the things, just as an aside, one of the things that you know, sometimes I find is that people want to refer to the Unity Mosque as the gay mosque. And sometimes it's some of our own folks, and a lot of times it's not our own folks. And what I always say to my friends is, like, don't say that. Don't make it the gay mosque. It's a very convenient way of relegating the work of this space into a marginalized community and saying it's not relevant to everybody else. The reality is that 40 to 50% of my congregation is not queer or trans identified. And why are they choosing to come into a mosque that is articulated as being LGBTIQ affirming? And why are they choosing? Well, one of the founders of the Madison Unity Mosque, one of my long distance congregants, is an academic, and her recent paper shows that a lot of the Muslims who are not queer or trans identified who come into spaces do so because they are allies. And that's an explicit, the queer and trans affirming space is actually intrinsic to what brings them into that space. So I say don't make this a gay space. It's actually an inclusive space. And if you can't deal with the parameters of what that means, then you shouldn't be here. There's lots of other places. We have great apps that tell you, you know, where the nearest mosque is in a city like Toronto. There's plenty. So, you know, you can go down the street and be happy on your own time, in your own place, not here.
Is Unity Mosque on those apps, Alfred? I'm curious.
No, we're not, because I don't put, so we meet in different communities. We don't have a regular venue. We do have regular venues, but we don't have a designated space. So we meet in community centers. Our day our Friday program is at a one community center. Our evening programs are usually at a different community center. And I don't put the address out because I actually want to know, even on the Facebook group or so on, as to who you are. And so there's a little bit of a screening that goes on where, you know, where we want to change the world. That's not going to happen in a day. So it's better to pace ourselves and grow incrementally rather than otherwise.
And I think one of my colleagues, this was a discussion on Twitter recently, similarly said, all are welcome, but certain hateful behaviors are not. Right. And I think that gets to some of what you're getting at, Brendan. And, you know, with as churches moved online for us, and I'm sure many other folks worshiping communities have moved online, it's been this whole how public do you make it, right? Because back in the day when we could meet in person, which seems like years ago now, our address was published on our website. You know, people knew that they could come in at 5 o'clock. Like, we don't have our own space, so we meet, you know, at a Lutheran church that hosts us. And the doors are open. And people who believe in what we believe and share our mission and our values and our inclusivity could come in, and people who don't could come in. And there was a time when we had protesters outside our church on a regular basis, that was just the way that it was, because they're just like, well, women shouldn't be ordained and women should not be priests and all of that. And that's sort of gone by the wayside now. And folks have mixed reactions. Some folks say, well, if they're not protesting us, clearly we're not stirring, you know, causing enough trouble or holy chaos, as it were. And other folks were like, well, it's nice that we can come here on Sundays in peace and we don't have to make it through mobs of protesters. And I think, you know, there's some of that. But people would often ask when we used to meet in person, of like, if so-and-so who's homophobic or who's transphobic, you know, certain leaders or something would come in, what would you do? And I said, well, despite the fact that I might want to have a certain reaction, as a pastor, as a priest, my job is to say, you are welcome here. And maybe God or the Spirit will move something in you during your time here with us. You know, however, all that being said, you threaten or harm one of our congregation or say something that is contrary to our mission or values, and then yes, I will ask you to leave. Like, you can't just come into our space and say, oh, trans people are abominations, and think that we're not going to take steps to remove you from the space, whether it's online or in person. You know, like, and that's for the protection of our community members. Yep. And whether it's to contradict, you know, because we've all had that spiritual violence, you know, perpetrated against us. So I think there's being inclusive and being welcoming, and then there's also protecting the most vulnerable, who are members of our communities.
Yeah, I don't have all that much to add here, other than, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of places, unfortunately, that one can go if they want to be homophobic or transphobic or racist, and there aren't, and the spaces that aren't that, it's just not within, it's not within the values of our space, and it's not within the values of the Torah, so.
Yeah. Totally. I appreciate those answers. And I always say to our communities, as I talk to churches about what it means to be truly inclusive, that what I've had to adopt is to say, to be truly inclusive, you can't include the exclusive. Like, if we're going to protect the community that we're trying to build from the margins, then we do have to draw some boundary lines. We do have to, as all of you said, ensure that people are protected from spiritual violence. And I'm grateful to hear I'm not alone in that either. So as we're really coming to the end, I want to ask a question that came in by two people actually, and this is a good way to end. And I'm gonna ask each of us to take 2 minutes or so if we have an answer to answer this question. And it's, what keeps you in your faith tradition as a faith leader, despite all of the hurdles and challenges and messiness of our traditions? Why do we stay?
I can, Allah in the Quran says, if I had wanted you all to be Muslim, I would have made you all Muslim. And so religious diversity and religious pluralism is integral to Islamic theology, not just mine, but most Muslim traditions historically. That not everybody is meant to be Muslim, which means that some people are meant to be this and some people are meant to be that. For me, I don't think being gay was a choice, and while I may consider it a gift now, there were certainly periods of my life where I tried to pray the gay away. And it's not something that I had a choice over. Honestly, I think that being Muslim is also something that's innate and intrinsic to my being. It's not necessarily to somebody else, but to my being. I have a choice, but if to be Muslim or not. But if I wasn't Muslim, if I had to not be Muslim, I'm not sure that it would be my choice. It would be something that I would be forced or pressured into. So to me, this framing of my spiritual and religious essence is also something that's innate and fundamental to me. I didn't choose it. My husband chose to be Muslim. But that's his path, right? And I know people who have come into Islam in the weirdest and the strangest of ways. And I know people who've come into other faith traditions where it can only be called a calling of the divine, right? So my calling is here. This is my space. This is my bed. And that's why I stay, because it is something that's fundamental to who I am and to what I am. So
I spent some time during seminary and after it working in other churches, because I kind of felt I had there was no place for me in the Catholic Church. And I did not see a future for myself between my gender identity, my sexuality, my call to ministry. I was like, okay, I got three strikes against me. This is not going to happen. And jobs were equally clear with me as, this is not going to happen. Like, one of those things we could maybe fudge, but the fact that all three, you know, so it was hard for me. But I think what led me back is that it was a sense of home, you know, that this is where God has called me, and I'm not going to let some church officials tell me that this is not my church. You know, that they can try to kick me out, they can kick me out, they can excommunicate me. That did sort of happen already. But it's mine. You know, they don't, who gives them that authority to do it? Because my faith is my faith. And, you know, I feel called to serve people, and I'm going to keep doing that with or without recognition from, you know, certain authorities. And if it means having to be a scrappy little church, then so be it. But I think there's beauty in that as well.
Yeah. And, you know, it's almost like I get asked this question a lot from usually straight people. Like, people will say, like, if I were gay, I would definitely leave Judaism. And I'm like, well, shows like how much you, I wouldn't say this, like, shows how much you believe in Judaism. It's like, I mean, for me, this is my life. I love it. I mean, there's so many, this is my community. We just had the holiday of Passover, which was very different because I couldn't go to, usually you go to your family. I couldn't go to my family because of the social distancing, and I couldn't go to synagogue or any. Usually the Seder is done with a lot of people, and we just did it in our little apartment, me and my husband here in New York City. And, you know, it's a difficult situation, but in some ways it was amazing because I got to like make the traditional foods and make all the traditional blessings and lead the service of the Seder which I wouldn't normally do. It's usually done by either my father or an elder figure in the room, and it's just there's so much. It's such a rich life, and I mean, when there was the first rabbinical school I went to denied my ordination, and when they were debating it, I said to them, you know what, you want to debate my ordination, you guys can do that, but you can't debate whether or not I'm religious, whether I'm Jewish. That's not a matter of debate. That's part of me, that's something I love, and that's my life. And you know what? So I went elsewhere, got ordained elsewhere. It's hard to even, I think that's a good concluding thing. You know, some real place where queer people can be not just accepted, but leaders of religious communities, is because we've all had to struggle in some ways. And by living through that struggle, you have to have some sort of strong core of faith.
Those are beautiful, seriously. And I just want to say thank you to each one of you for joining us, especially the East Coasters for staying up. But it is good to be with each one of you. I'm grateful for your work and your witness in the world. And I can tell from all the comments coming in, so many people are saying thank you. So on behalf of all of us here at San Diego Pride, thank you to you all for being with us. And to those who have watched us, this is our first Devout Forum. And we have many more coming, hopefully, in the future. So with that, thank you. And I hope you all have a really great night.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandon. Nice to meet you all. Nice to meet you both, Daniel and Corey.
Likewise. Yeah. All right, take care. Have a good night.
Good night.